undeniable is that in the last half century, our understanding of molecular complexities has greatly increased, and with it the challenges to evolution. Behe has compared the problem to looking down at the ground from 30,000 feet. From that height, he said, the terrain's details are invisible. It's hard to see the difficulties that creeks and ravines presented to American pioneers traveling in covered wagons. In much the same way, evolutionist ideas are comparable to looking down from an airplane and imagining that a trek from one large feature to another wouldn't be difficult. As science probes ever deeper into the molecular details of life, serious evolutionary thought has been forced to descend from 30,000 feet to ground level, and grave obstacles to undirected evolution have become manifest. Ever more powerful microscopes, instead of illuminating Darwin's theory, have pointed to numerous obstacles in its path. The cell. Not surprisingly, 19th century naturalists conceived of life in an oversimplified way. Consider the cell, first seen in a strip of cork by Robert Hooke in 1685. It resembled monastic cells, hence the name. But its interior was not remotely understood. Darwin knew nothing of what went on inside a cell. At one point in the origin, he used the phrase merely of cellular tissue, seemingly confident that the cells themselves wouldn't pose any great difficulties. Some have claimed that Darwin did understand cellular complexity, citing a letter in which he quoted G.H. Lewes, the novelist George Eliot's friend. But Lewes, no wiser than any scientist of his time, was a poor source. He said the cell was a structure of exaggerated importance, with mysterious powers, surrounded by a microscopic lump of jelly-like substance called protoplasm, and the protoplasm lacked any trace of organization. At the same time, the German biologist and Darwin admirer Ernst Haeckel believed that the cell was a homogeneous lump of protoplasm. He went to see Darwin in England and promoted his theory. He also met T.H. Huxley, who said that protoplasm is the physical basis of all life. It is the clay of the potter. Today we know that a cell performs many functions, absorbing nutrients, metabolizing them, manufacturing proteins, dividing itself into two cells, operating in a complex cycle, communicating with other cells, and excreting wastes. The cell contains numerous raw ingredients, including water, carbohydrates, ions and fats, but organelles constructed of proteins do most of the work. By one account, a typical bacterium, a prokaryote with no nucleus, requires more than 4,000 proteins to function. Biologists have addressed the complexity of the cellular world with various metaphors. Some have compared its activity to that of a town full of people, with its own microfactories and transportation systems. The British ethologist W.H. Thorpe said in the 1960s that the most elementary type of cell constitutes a mechanism unimaginably more complex than any machine yet thought up, let alone constructed, by man. There may be 50 trillion cells in the human body, or double that number. They've never been counted. Cells, except for cancer cells, also know when to replicate. Within the human body, cells are divided into perhaps 200 types, skin cells, kidney cells, and so on. But others say that 200 is an undercount. Oddly enough, classical genetics began in a monastery with the work of the Augustinian friar Gregor Mendel. In 1866, he proposed the existence of independent factors, thought of as abstract particles, which determine the traits carried by pea plants. The Danish botanist Wilhelm Johansson was the first to call them genes. That was in 1909. He also distinguished between genotype and phenotype. But Mendel's work was not widely noticed until 1900, and Darwin didn't know about it. Later, genes were assumed to be contiguous sequences of DNA and were thought to construct identifiable body parts or traits. But the Harvard geneticist Richard Lewontin criticized that idea, saying we don't have genes for noses. Genes for parts of the body, or for height, size, or traits like intelligence have never been found. The British geneticist Steve Jones said in 2011 that we know of more than 50 different genes associated with height. Most human traits are influenced by so many genes, Jones said, that there is no likely systematic cause and effect. In fact, the gene itself has become ever more difficult to define. Today, genes are defined less in terms of what they are and more in terms of what they do. They help construct proteins. The molecular revolution. With electron microscopes opening up a whole new world, biology departments soon embraced the molecular revolution. After all, a closer look at DNA was far more likely to turn up something new and interesting than one more look at old fossils. In addition, molecular structures haven't changed, at least not since Darwin's time. If the molecular folk need more information, nothing stops them from peering anew into their microscopes. Francis Crick discussed the transition to molecular biology in his memoir, What Mad Pursuit, 1988. The classical period of molecular biology, he wrote, stretched from the discovery of the DNA double helix in 1953 till about 1966, when the genetic code, the dictionary relating the nucleic acid language to the protein language, was finally elucidated. Also in 1966, as it happened, participants in a symposium at the Wistar Institute challenged Darwinism using molecular data. The skeptics argued that it is extremely difficult to assemble a new protein by chance, as Darwinianism requires, because of its huge improbability. Billions of amino acid sequences are possible in constructing a protein, but few are chosen. A wrong sequence means that the protein won't work. The Wistar event was titled Mathematical Challenges to the Neo-Darwinian Interpretation of Evolution. It was something that Darwinism had not encountered before. As we saw in Chapter 13, Bill Gates said that DNA is like a computer program, but far, far more advanced than any software ever created. So what created DNA? Bearing in mind that Darwinism only permits accidental events. Furthermore, natural selection cannot play a role until self-replicating organisms come into existence. Francis Crick, 1916-2004. Biologists must constantly keep in mind that what they see was not designed, but rather evolved, Francis Crick said, reminding us of Richard Dawkins. An atheist, Crick signed the Humanist Manifesto and called for humanism to replace religion as a guiding force for humanity. Once rid of Christian beliefs, we could get down to the serious problem of trying to find out what the world is all about. Crick accepted an honorary fellowship from the newly founded Churchill College at Cambridge, but then resigned in protest when it accepted a donation to build a chapel. Like Julian Huxley and Darwin himself, Crick was sympathetic to eugenics. He viewed infanticide as acceptable and argued that rich people should have more children. In 1977, he moved to the Salk Institute in San Diego and took up neuroscience in a forlorn attempt to explain consciousness. In Crick's sequence hypothesis, the nucleotide bases of DNA function like letters in a written language or symbols in a computer code. But as in spelling tests, the letter sequence is important. In the following quotation, Crick discusses the improbability of these events. To generate this miracle of molecular construction, he wrote, all the cell need do is to string together the amino acids which make up the polypeptide chain in the correct order. This is a complicated biochemical process, a molecular assembly line using instructions in the form of a nucleic acid tape, the so-called messenger RNA. Here we need only ask, how many possible proteins are there? If a particular amino acid sequence was selected by chance, how rare an event would that be? This is an easy exercise in combinatorials. Suppose the chain is about 200 amino acids long. This is, if anything, rather less than the average length of proteins of all types. Since we have just 20 possibilities at each place, the number of possibilities is 20 multiplied by itself some 200 times. This is conveniently written 20 to the 200th power and is approximately equal to 10 to the 260th power. That is, a 1 followed by 260 zeros. This number is quite beyond our everyday comprehension. Richard Lewontin then pointed out the chicken and egg problem. The proteins of the cell are made from other proteins, and without that protein-forming machinery, nothing can be made. There is an appearance here of infinite regress. What makes the proteins that are necessary to make the protein? That, said David Goodsell, the author of The Machinery of Life, is one of the unanswered riddles of biochemistry. Which came first, proteins or protein synthesis? If proteins are needed to make proteins, how did the whole thing get started? Crick understood that something as complex as a protein evolving by chance was highly improbable. So he became interested in directed panspermia. Once self-replicating bacteria originated somewhere in the universe, they could be spread by intelligent life forms using spaceships to propel the minute critters through interstellar space. Crick used the word directed to imply that someone had deliberately sent bacteria to other planets. His theory was obviously very speculative, he allowed. So he had quietly relocated the problem to another planet. One is tempted to comment. Anything was preferable to bringing God back into the details. Fred Hoyle, 1915 to 2001. The astronomer Fred Hoyle was the same age as Crick and also did most of his work at Cambridge. But temperamentally, they were quite different. In his later years, Hoyle threw up his hands when confronted by the molecular improbabilities and became an open skeptic. He learned something about cladistics from Colin Paterson at London's Natural History Museum and understood the weakness of the case for Darwinism. Hoyle became critical of the belief that life evolved from non-life here on Earth. The odds were too long. Like Crick, he promoted the idea that life on Earth originated in space, spreading through the universe via panspermia. Evolution, he believed, was given a head start on Earth by an influx of viruses arriving accidentally via comets or meteorites. In 1982, Hoyle presented Evolution from Space for the Royal Institution's Omni Lecture. In his calculation, the odds of obtaining the required set of biomolecules for even the simplest living cell without panspermia were even smaller than Crick's. The difference between an intelligent ordering, whether of words, fruit boxes, amino acids, or the Rubik's Cube, and merely random shufflings can be fantastically large, Hoyle wrote. He compared it to the probability that a large number of blind men would correctly align a scrambled Rubik's Cube and all come up with the right solution at the same moment. More from Hoyle. So if one proceeds directly and straightforwardly in this matter, without being deflected by a fear of incurring the wrath of scientific opinion, one arrives at the conclusion that biomaterials, with their amazing measure of order, must be the outcome of intelligent design. No other possibility I have been able to think of in pondering this issue over quite a long time seems to me to have anything like as high a possibility of being true. Hoyle also published a book called The Intelligent Universe in 1983, so he can be seen as an early proponent of what a decade later became the intelligent design movement. He regarded the notion that the operating program of a living cell could be arrived at by chance in a primordial organic soup here on the Earth as nonsense of a high order. Hoyle re-emphasized the point with his famous comment about a tornado in a junkyard. The chance that higher life forms might have emerged in this way by random events is comparable to the chance that a tornado sweeping through a junkyard might assemble a Boeing 747 from the materials therein. The evolutionary biologist John Maynard Smith responded to Hoyle in The Problems of Biology, 1986. What is wrong with it, he asked. Essentially, it is that no biologist imagines that complex structures arise in a single step. But his reply would have been more convincing if he had pointed to cases where organisms had been observed to assemble themselves bit by bit. That has never been seen. Maynard Smith also said that even proteins formed as a random sequence of amino acids have some slight catalytic activity. But that is now questioned. Just getting the slightest activity requires a protein with stable functional folds, which is highly improbable. As David Goodsell said in The Machinery of Life, only a small fraction of the possible combinations of amino acids will fold spontaneously into a stable structure. If you make a protein with a random sequence of amino acids, chances are that it will only form a gooey tangle when placed in water. After Fred Hoyle's death in 2001, his assistant, Chandra Wickramasinghe, a Sri Lankan-born astronomer and astrobiologist, said that in the highly polarized polemic between Darwinism and creationism, our position is unique. Although we do not align ourselves with either side, both sides treat us as opponents. Junk DNA. The DNA molecule, with its 3 billion letters, or nucleotides, is conventionally divided into stretches called exons, which carry sequence information for proteins, and, in the higher animals, much longer stretches called introns. These are interposed between the exons, and, when they are spliced out, leave exons in connected segments. The exons are then transcribed into RNA chains that participate in protein synthesis. In 1988, Crick boldly called exons the sense bits, while the excised introns he called the nonsense sequences. The existence of introns came as almost a complete surprise, Crick allowed. Nobody had clearly postulated their existence before experimenters stumbled on them by accident. Classical genetics gave us no hint of them. In What Mad Pursuit, Crick elaborated on the exon-intron distinction. Much of our DNA, perhaps as much as 90%, appeared at first sight to be unnecessary junk. Even if it had some use, its function probably did not depend on the exact details of its sequence. Leslie Orgel and I wrote an article suggesting that much of it was selfish DNA. A better term might be parasitic DNA. The concept of junk DNA strongly appealed to Darwinists, who thought that nonsense sequences were to be expected if DNA was constructed by random mutation. Crick put it just that way. The possible existence of such selfish DNA, or junk, is exactly what might be expected from the theory of natural selection. But this prediction of evolution, like many others, has been dashed by recent research. Human Genome Project. At the start of the Human Genome Project, funded by the National Institutes of Health and promoted by James Watson, among others, the number of human genes was estimated at 100,000 to 150,000. Thus, Scientific American began one story, "Now that all the 100,000 or so genes that make up the human genome have been deciphered," many of these non-existent genes were even patented. Craig Venter and Francis Collins of the National Institutes of Health then brought everyone down to earth with a very different count, maybe only 30,000 genes. We have only twice as many genes as a fruit fly or a lowly nematode worm, said Eric Lander, a biology professor at MIT and a fellow traveler aboard the Human Genome Project. Today there are thought to be 19,000 human genes, actually fewer than are found in worms. One obvious conclusion is that the concept of a gene is of questionable value. Nature pursued that idea in 2006 in an article titled, "What is a Gene?" The magazine's summary, "The idea of genes as beads on a string is fast fading." The one gene, one protein idea was also coming under assault. We've come to the realization that the genome is full of overlapping transcripts, one researcher said. With the publication of the Encyclopedia of DNA Elements, ENCODE, project in 2012, the idea that most DNA was junk, as Crick had thought, was shown to be wrong. More than 30 papers in various journals, including Nature, Science, and Cell, reported that many of the vast stretches of seeming junk comprising maybe 95% of the DNA are the seat of crucial functional activity. ENCODE showed that as much as 80% of the human genome is biochemically active. Junk DNA, once welcomed by Darwinists as proof that evolution proceeds by random meandering, turned out to be another disappointment. Irreducible complexity. Michael Behe made a case for the irreducible complexity of molecular structures in Darwin's Black Box, 1996. He had in mind the bacterial flagellum, a tiny rotary engine attached to certain bacteria and functioning as a propeller, like an outboard motor. The flagellum is composed of numerous parts. Behe's essential point was that every one of these parts must be operational before the flagellum can function. Possessing just some of those parts wouldn't do. Also, the flagellum can't expect the deus ex machina of natural selection to develop the organ bit by bit. One expert who has agreed with Behe is microbiologist James Shapiro. In a review of Behe's book, he wrote, "There are no detailed Darwinian accounts for the evolution of any fundamental biochemical or cellular system, only a variety of wishful speculations. It would seem to be safe to assume that the great majority of molecular machines, not just the flagellum, are also irreducibly complex." Conflict between molecular and anatomical trees. We can construct a tree of life based solely on the basis of similarities of DNA sequences, said Francis Collins in The Language of God, A Scientist Presents Evidence for Belief, 2006. The tree does not utilize anatomic observations of current life forms. Yet, he said, its similarity to conclusions drawn from studies of comparative anatomy is striking. This claim is simply false, says Jonathan Wells. First, DNA-based trees are often in conflict with each other, and they also differ from those derived from comparative anatomy. Here is an example of a conflict between DNA trees. Francis Collins's results showed flying lemurs as closely related to tree shrews, with rabbits and monkeys on more distant branches. Yet a separate study published in 2002 showed flying lemurs as more closely related to monkeys, with tree shrews closely related to rabbits. Jonathan Wells wrote that conflicts based on different DNA-based trees are a major headache for evolutionary biologists, some of whom spend their entire careers attempting to resolve them. Furthermore, phylogenies constructed with DNA often conflict with those based on anatomy. Consider whales. In the 1960s, the evolutionary biologist Lee Van Valen proposed on anatomical grounds that whales are descended from an extinct group of hyena-like animals. But in the 1990s, molecular comparisons suggested that whales are more closely related to hippopotamuses. Discovery Institute's Anne Gauger, Ph.D. in Developmental Biology, University of Washington, makes the same point. She explained that while baboons and mandrills were once placed together due to morphology, modern phylogenetics based on DNA separates them. Morphology and DNA give different patterns, and groupings based on morphology can be overturned by DNA similarities. There is an additional problem, and to understand it, we must return to Darwin's theory, in which natural selection acts on variations. The source of variation was not known, but differences between the generations could readily be observed. Natural selection, then, went to work, and only the fittest variation survived. That was how evolution unfolded, as Darwin saw it. Then, with the discovery of DNA and its 3 billion nucleotides, the source of variation was more precisely identified. It was mutation. Some of the nucleotides periodically mutated, and mutations were, quite reasonably, construed as errors. They could be compared to typos made by a typist in copying a manuscript, which is then passed on to the next generation. Then more typos are added. Analogously, Darwinians believe that when enough errors or mutations are added, a new species emerges from the old. But that's like believing that if there are enough typos, a poem by Shakespeare will eventually be transformed into one by Wordsworth. David Berlinsky made just such a criticism of Darwinism in his book, The Devil's Delusion. Recently, however, we have learned that to preserve the information encoded in the genome, organisms go to great lengths to prevent such errors from appearing. Cells have error-correcting mechanisms built into them. If such proofreading was absent, an organism would soon become little more than a mass of mutations, and not long for this world. At the molecular level, then, we see that what had once been thought of as the source of variation and fitness became instead a source of errors, ultimately leading to speciation. Darwin of the Gaps. Kenneth Miller, a committed Darwin defender and professor of biology, said that cells are filled with structures whose detailed evolutionary origins are not known. Therefore, those who argue against evolution might pick nearly any cellular structure, the ribosome, for example, and claim correctly that its origin has not been explained in detail by evolution. Such arguments are easy to make, of course, but the nature of scientific progress renders them far from compelling. The lack of a detailed current explanation for a structure, organ, or process does not mean that science will never come up with one. In his 1999 book, Finding Darwin's God, Miller made the familiar God of the Gaps argument. Creationists, he said, like to plug God into whatever Darwin didn't explain. But as humans began to find material explanations for ordinary events, he added, the gods broke into retreat. But notice that Miller introduces his own gap argument in discussing the origin of cellular structures. We might call it Darwin of the Gaps. We haven't found a material explanation for these molecular details yet, but, he adds in a touching appeal to faith, given scientific progress, we shouldn't assume that science will never come up with one. A work in progress. Molecular biology is still a work in progress, and little that we read today should be regarded as final. Consider the recent and destabilizing claims made on behalf of epigenetics, and then on behalf of horizontal gene transfer. Epigenetics is the study of small chemical markers placed on top of the four DNA letters that constitute the genome. Environmental factors help determine where these markers are placed, and they in turn influence whether or not a gene is turned on or off. In other words, what is in the environment can influence gene expression. Nature reported in 2013 that in some organisms, these markers are passed on to the next generation. If so, environmental factors affect gene expression not only in the present generation, but also in the next, and maybe the one after that. In 2014, Science magazine writer Jocelyn Kaiser called epigenetics researcher Michael Skinner a heretic for maintaining that chemicals can cause changes in gene expression that persist across generations. But Skinner thought that epigenetics may become the biggest paradigm shift in science in recent history. Some biomedical and epidemiological research has suggested, for example, that a susceptibility to diabetes and heart disease can be passed on by factors picked up environmentally and then passed on to later generations. All this potentially puts us back into Lamarckian territory. We may recall that Darwin resorted to Lamarckism when his original theory was challenged by the Scottish engineer Fleming Jenkin in 1867. Jenkin said that helpful variations occurring accidentally would soon be swamped by unhelpful variations in later generations. Darwin's appeal to a Lamarckian mechanism ran up against the refutation that the offspring of mice whose tails are cut off still have tails. But as we have just seen, epigenetics shows that this refutation of the inheritance of acquired characteristics may no longer be decisive. In lateral or horizontal gene transfer, LGT/HGT, Organisms of different species living in the same environment transfer genes from one to the other. LGT, which has attracted attention in science journals recently, is common in bacteria and is thought to explain how they can generate resistance to antibiotics. It's as though immune bacteria are able to come to the rescue of vulnerable ones. According to Alastair Crisp, a researcher at Cambridge University, it appears that horizontal gene transfer has contributed to the evolution of many, perhaps all, animals, including humans, giving rise to tens or hundreds of active foreign genes. Crisp went on to say, "The process is ongoing, meaning that we may need to reevaluate how we think about evolution." Casey Luskin essentially agreed with Crisp, adding that gene transfers show that biologists have uncovered genetic data sharply at variance with universal common descent. Common descent implies that genes are inherited from parental generations and not from neighbors. Laterally transferred genes don't fit the standard evolutionary phylogeny, suggesting that the Darwinian tree of life may have to be rethought. Michael Behe said that it's a reasonable deduction to think that some genes were transferred between bacteria by viruses. Viruses seem able to do so by engulfing the cellular debris of bacteria, or by other means. Behe also said that he doesn't think the horizontal transfer explains the origin of a new use for the gene in the new bacterium. One can swap parts between a tool shop that works in the metric system with a tool shop that works with English measurements, but that won't tell you how new complex machinery is put together in the first place. In light of what we know about recent developments, Michael Behe commented that the cell's known complexity has increased immeasurably in recent years, and points ever more insistently to an intelligent designer as its cause. In summary, the tendency of genomics has been to undermine the old Darwinian verities in a way that organismal biology never could. In particular, we have seen the huge improbability of finding the DNA sequences that generate correct protein folding. All the indications are that as scientific progress continues, with more and more complexities likely to appear, the molecular headaches for Darwin's theory will only increase. Chapter 16. Lenski's Evolving Bacteria. Single-celled organisms, called Escherichia coli, exist in the billions in the guts of animals, including humans. They are usually helpful, sometimes neutral, and occasionally harmful. But in his lab at Michigan State, Richard Lenski has been observing E. coli without any medical goal in mind, and he has observed them continuously since February 1988. Bacteria divide, much as cells of the body divide. As they can replicate asexually every 40 minutes, Lenski and his lab assistants have seen a lot of bacterial divisions. The 60,000 generation mark was reached in April 2014. Today it is closer to 65,000. The experiment is supported by a grant from the National Science Foundation. Lenski calls it his long-term evolution experiment. His underlying argument is that even in the absence of selection pressure, E. coli will evolve on their own, given enough time or bacterial divisions. A member of the National Academy of Sciences and the Hanna Distinguished Professor of Microbial Ecology at Michigan State University, Lenski has focused on genetic mechanisms that drive evolutionary change, his lab reported. 25 years of E. coli divisions are said to be the equivalent of 1 million years for humans. Others say it is closer to 1.5 million years. Well-known science journals soon became Lenski's greatest admirers. Elizabeth Panisi's article about him in Science, published in 2013, covered four full pages of the magazine. It was headlined, "The Man Who Bottled Evolution," with this subhead: Richard Lenski's 25-year experiment in bacterial evolution shows no signs of running out of surprises about how mutation and selection shape living things. Lenski and assistants grow bacteria in a dozen nutrient-filled flasks. Then, every day, 1% of the population of each flask is transferred to a new flask of fresh growth medium. Under these conditions, each population experiences 6.6 generations, or doublings, per day. The flasks are kept separate from each other so that the 12 different lines of descent don't get intermingled. Richard Dawkins has called the separate flasks tribes. About every 500 generations, taking about 8 weeks, Lenski and his helpers deposit bacteria from each flask into a freezer. These become the ancestors. They can be thawed whenever needed and then compared to their most recent descendants. In this way, Lenski has created a fossil record of his bacteria. The experiment continued along these lines for over 25 years. Carl Zimmer, a journalist and the author of Evolution, The Triumph of an Idea, 2001, reported in Discover magazine that the bacteria have been evolving in all sorts of interesting ways, and the freezing and thawing has allowed Lenski to reconstruct the history of that evolution in great detail. The experiment is an absolutely magnificent achievement, said Douglas Fatuima, an evolutionary biologist and textbook writer at Stony Brook University. Richard Dawkins said that it is a beautiful demonstration of evolution in action, something it is hard to laugh off even when your motivation to do so is very strong. And for creationists, Dawkins added, that motivation is very strong indeed. But before we get carried away, now may be the time to mention what is easy to lose sight of. That after so many generations and so much evolving, the bacteria remain bacteria to this day. It seems likely that they will stay that way for as long as the experiment lasts. It has no defined endpoint, says Lenski, but he wants others to keep it going after he retires. He would like to see his experiment continue for another 25 years. The biochemist Michael Behe told me that the experiment can show you what can happen in long-term evolution. In his 2010 article on Lenski's experiment in the Quarterly Review of Biology, Behe pointed out that when trillions of bacteria replicate over 60,000 generations, numerous mutations are to be expected. Yet the most important evolutionary changes observed so far have involved the loss of old genetic functions rather than the acquisition of new ones. Behe said that he disagreed with Lenski's interpretations, but nonetheless he is a big fan of his work. He explained why. Although Lenski is decidedly not an intelligent design proponent, his work enables us to see what evolution actually does when it has the resources of a large number of organisms over a substantial number of generations. Rather than speculate, Lenski and his co-workers have observed the workings of mutation and selection. For this, we intelligent design proponents should be very grateful. In his 2007 book, The Edge of Evolution, Behe said that unlike other microorganisms, which have to fend for themselves and contend with the human immune system, Lenski's bacteria have been coddled. One might say that they are on welfare. They have food, a stable environment, and no predators. But doesn't evolution need a change in the environment to spur it on, Behe asked. And he further asked, shouldn't we expect little evolution of E. coli in the lab where its environment is totally controlled? Behe answered both questions, no and no. One of the most important factors in an organism's environment is the presence of other organisms. Even in a controlled lab culture where bacteria are warm and well-fed, the bug that reproduces fastest or outcompetes others will dominate the population. Like gravity, Darwinian evolution never stops. So Behe would concur, at least in part, when Lenski said in a National Science Foundation press release, most of us think about evolution in the past tense. After all, we were first exposed to the concept of evolution when we saw dinosaurs and other fossils at museums. But evolution has not stopped. It is an ongoing process. Charles Darwin emphasized this point when he closed on The Origin of Species by saying, from so simple a beginning, endless forms, most beautiful and most wonderful, have been and are being evolved. Behe agrees that evolution can be thought of in the present tense. But of course, the big difference between Darwin's theory and Lenski's experiment is that Lenski began with E. coli in his flasks, and that is what he still has over a quarter of a century later. Yes, there have been some changes. A year or two after the experiment began, Something happened within the flasks, making the bacteria reproduce faster and take over the flask they were growing in. So there was a mutation, and it conferred a survival advantage on the bacteria. Lenski would say that was just what Darwin would predict. Then later on, here comes another mutation, and that helped even more. That was true enough, and it attracted headlines in the newspapers. But what changed exactly? The problem initially was that Lenski had no way of knowing the molecular details of those changes. All he knew was that the bacteria would grow faster. Also, the average size of the E. coli increased. Then in about 2005, new genome sequencing technology made it possible to read the DNA letter by letter. Today, the entire genome of E. coli has been sequenced, and the frozen record of Lenski's ancestral bacteria has allowed comparisons to be made between the bacterial old-timers and their most recent descendants. Unlike humans, bacteria don't mind being frozen, then thawed, and studied all over again. But once Lenski's lab did identify the mutations at the DNA level, many of the beneficial mutations turned out to be degradative ones. They were breaking or deleting pre-existing genes or regulatory elements, meaning that those genes or elements no longer worked. This is something that Lenski's enthusiasts, including Richard Dawkins and Jerry Coyne, the latter in Why Evolution is True, have failed to point out. Lenski himself is inclined to emphasize the positive in his experiment and to downplay the degrading of genes. Sometimes a broken gene can actually help an organism, under the conditions in which it was grown, Behe pointed out. He gave this example. One change that helped the bacteria grow faster was that they lost their ability to make flagella, so the bacterial flagellum was essentially thrown out. The reason was that in his flasks, the bacteria were shaken while they were growing, so no bacterium had to swim. Why spend energy on something when you can get a free ride? But that does not explain where the flagella came from in the first place. From this, Behe formulated his first rule of adaptive evolution. Break or blunt any functional coded element whose loss would yield a net fitness gain. He also emphasized the huge difference between constructing something and demolishing it. Blowing up a bridge is not the opposite of making one, he said. In fact, knowing how to demolish something tells you little or nothing about what was needed to build it in the first place. That was one of the very interesting things, and it wasn't just the flagella. A number of other genes were not needed anymore because all the nutrients that the bacteria needed were supplied in the flask. So the ones that were needed in a normal environment were broken and thrown away. In a paper in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, Lenski gave another example. One of the mutations removed the ability of bacteria to proofread their own DNA. Normally, mistakes get incorporated into DNA, but as we saw in the previous chapter, cells have mechanisms to spell check a text and fix them where the mistakes are made, as a typist corrects a typo. But the bacteria in Lenski's flasks lost the ability to do this. However, the cells that had the mutation causing the loss of proofreading ability were growing just as fast as the previous cells that had the original proofreading ability. The question then was why the loss of proofreading ability didn't hamper the growth of the cells. When Lenski looked more closely to see what had caused this, it turned out that yet another protein had been lost by another mutation, and this loss had a compensating effect. Behe summarized the outcome this way. The initial mutation was the loss of one kind of protein, the kind that helped proofread it. And the second one, compensating for the loss of the first one, was the loss of a second protein. And that serendipitously helped. But you're going to run out of proteins to lose in a fairly short order if you keep on going like that. The most important claim, reported by Elizabeth Panisi and others, was that the bacteria had evolved a new way to feed themselves. Instead of relying on glucose, they drew on a different energy source in their medium, citrate, which enabled them to reach much higher densities than in other flasks. This was the biggest event in the entire E. coli experiment, said Lenski's assistant Christoph Adami. To have a complex new function develop seemingly from scratch is a big deal and quite remarkable. There was a lot of citrate in the medium, And in the absence of oxygen, the E. coli have no problem consuming citrate. But when oxygen is present, as it is in Lenski's experiment, the bacteria can't digest citrate. Later, however, they found that a fairly simple change made its digestion possible. Citrate then became the new food supply, and that allowed the mutated citrate-consuming bacterium to outcompete its relatives, Behe wrote. The ability to consume citrate became visually conspicuous in one flask at about the midpoint of the experiment, after about 33,000 generations. The normally clear flask became cloudy with the profusion of bacteria on citrate. But at the molecular level, nothing novel occurred. For as Behe explained, the change was relatively simple. A piece of DNA close to the citrate gene got duplicated by accident. That put a control element next to the citrate gene, which allowed it to be active in the presence of oxygen. Nothing novel occurred because the control element already existed beforehand. All that happened was a duplication of what was already there and a rearrangement of the positions of the gene and control element. The analogy of a single-lane highway becoming a two-lane highway has been used to account for the ability of the bacteria to consume citrate. And yet, I asked Behe, doesn't the building of a whole new highway lane seem like a fairly complex change? In response, he developed the analogy further. It is as though the highway lane were already there, he said, but blocked by a sawhorse barrier. The mutation essentially knocked the barrier away, and traffic could then use the pre-existing lane. Behe said that the Lenski experiment had failed to show beneficial mutations that resulted from building what he called new functional coded elements, FCTs. Roughly, that is a sequence of DNA that helps in the production or processing of a gene or a gene product. Improvements had been made by breaking existing genes or fiddling with them in minor ways. But new genes or regulatory elements still had not shown up. Richard Lenski was interviewed by National Public Radio for its morning edition in 2013, celebrating the 60,000th birthday of the bacteria. Random mutations had allowed the bacteria to improve their fitness, meaning to reproduce faster. In evolutionary biology, Lenski told NPR, fitness is this representation of the ability of an organism to survive and reproduce. All else being equal, organisms that reproduce more quickly will have an advantage when competing with those that reproduce more slowly. Readers may recall that Lenski brings us back to the same problem I began with at the beginning of this book. What does fitness mean? Lenski defines it in terms of faster reproduction. But the problem is that surviving even as you reproduce faster is not quite what Darwin had in mind when he talked about the mechanism, natural selection, that is said to explain the origin of species. In 1966, the geneticist C.H. Waddington said that some of the statements of neo-Darwinism are vacuous. Darwin's understanding of fitness was later turned into a lot of mathematics, Waddington added, and then it was redefined by Ernst Mayr, among others, simply in terms of leaving more offspring. Therefore, Lenski leaves us in the same place that Waddington criticized. Some E. coli, if left to their own devices, leave more offspring than others in a given time period, and that is all there is to it. The idea is smuggled in, to echo Waddington, that the bacteria leaving the most offspring are going to be the best. But nothing like this is explicit in the theory. Similarly, all Lenski has shown is that some organisms leave more offspring than others. Michael Behe summarized the experiment this way. Lenski's lab did an immense amount of careful work and deserves much praise. Yet the entirely separate $64,000 question is, what do the results show about the power of the Darwinian mechanism? The answer is they do not show it to be capable of anything more than what was already known. Chapter 17. The Sociobiology Wars. At the outset, Harvard's Edward O. Wilson, the world's leading expert on ants, was the villain. In 1975, he published the book that started the war, Sociobiology, The New Synthesis. with sociobiology defined as the systematic study of the biological basis of all social behavior. His early chapters dealing with insects were well received, but the final chapter, on human behavior, ignited the most tumultuous academic controversy of the 1970s, as Wilson himself wrote. Boyce Rensberger wrote a page one article for the New York Times, headlined, "Updating Darwin on Behavior." Earlier, insect societies were seen as evidence for the remarkable variety of nature, Rensberger wrote. But now there was something new. Beneath that variety were common behavioral patterns governed by the genes and shaped by Darwinian evolution. Behavior governed by the genes. That was the contentious issue. In 1963, the geneticist Theodosius Dobzhansky had summarized the older view. Culture is not inherited through genes. It is acquired by learning from other human beings. But Wilson's sociobiology tended to put the genes back in charge. One might say that he revived the old nature versus nurture debate. Richard Dawkins was one of many biologists who at first agreed with Wilson, but the storyline kept changing, and Dawkins took offense when Wilson sharply dissented from Dawkins's book, The Selfish Gene. Wilson also accused Dawkins of being a journalist, but all that came later. Wilson as philosopher and naturalist. Wilson once called himself a Roosevelt liberal turned pragmatic centrist. He grew up as a Baptist in Alabama and read the Bible through twice. Then, after studying science, he lost his faith. But unlike others in that position, he had no desire to purge religious feelings. So he tried to fortify the bleak philosophy of materialism by rethinking it as a consilient whole. Preferring a search for objective reality over revelation is another way of satisfying religious hunger, he wrote. He presented his dream of a unifying theory in Consilience, 1998. Ever wider fields of knowledge were united in single Ionian enchantment. Everything can be reduced to the laws of physics. Everything evolved. Mind is matter. One day I went to see Wilson at his Harvard office. He showed me the ants patrolling about behind clear glass without paying us any mind. He talked most interestingly about them for an hour or more. Ants come in maybe 12,000 species, but there may be twice that number. The vast majority have never been studied by anyone. Ants are rarely fossilized, but sometimes they are trapped in amber. What did ants evolve from? We don't know, but wasps are one possibility. Like many other visitors, I left wanting to know more. When he is describing his ants, discovering their pheromones, or writing about olfactory communication among animals, Wilson is being what he calls himself, a naturalist, and an impressive one. But consilience, in which everything is interconnected, was questionable. It was fluid enough that almost anything under the sun could be explained. Genes versus instincts. In the pre-gene decades, animal behavior was often attributed to instinct. In The Origin, Darwin attributed to the hive bee making its cells an instinct so wonderful that some might see it as sufficient to overthrow my whole theory. Later, however, instinct fell out of favor as an explanatory term. It glossed over mechanisms that are not remotely understood. The history of science has often shown this tendency. A new concept creates the illusion of explanation for a while. Then it wears thin, and philosophers must invent something new. So instinct was replaced by genes, thought of as the material cause of a vast range of human traits and maladies. The powers imputed to genes reached a peak with the decoding of the human genome at the turn of the new century. Gene-driven animals did whatever was needed to find food, avoid predators, make nests, reproduce, and so on. They didn't have to learn, only obey, as Wilson put it. Ants are hardwired. Once born, they march off and do their thing without trial or error. When Conrad Lorenz allowed that all these marbles must have developed through material evolution by natural selection, the youthful Wilson was well pleased. He secured my allegiance. Ideological conflicts. It's worth noting that the sociobiology conflict divided scientists whose shared beliefs were otherwise quite fundamental. Those who quarreled over sociobiology all accepted materialism as a given. Mind and consciousness emerged from matter. And for all parties to the dispute, reliance on a creator or an intelligent agent was excluded ab initio. Yet despite these agreements, sociobiology pitted scientist against scientist. One might think that an expanded version of Darwinism that explained the behavior of both humans and ants in materialistic terms would win the universal acclaim of materialists and would offend only the religious. Yet the cry of indignation against genetically induced human behavior arose not from Christians, few of whom noticed, but from a handful of leftists, mostly based in Cambridge, Massachusetts. A well-known opponent was Richard Lewontin, like Wilson, born in 1929, whose office was one floor below Wilson's. Paradoxically, Wilson the naturalist was on the side of the genes, while Lewontin, the geneticist, was on the side of culture, to oversimplify. His best-known ally was Stephen Jay Gould, 1941 to 2002. For the left, the argument, framed in terms of genes, was too deterministic. How could a new society appear if our tiny masters, that is, our genes, held us, as Wilson said, on a leash? Such a vision could only discourage revolutionary change. So the study group of Science for the People led a counterattack. The left's critique was often irresponsible, its wild accusations contrasting sharply with Wilson's moderate views. The low point came in 1978. At a meeting in Washington, a protester dumped a jug of water over Wilson's head while others denounced his supposed encouragement of genocide and racism. Even as ice cubes were sliding down his back, Wilson had the presence of mind to note that Garland Allen, a science historian in the audience, had taken the floor to say why the attack had been justified. He said it was all of a piece, Wilson recalled. Since the 19th century, there had been a strong bias toward genetic determinism, the claim being that human beings are fixed in their destiny by their genes. Therefore, there was nothing we could do about it. Therefore, the existing order is the best possible order, validating the ruling class in their position. It was all a part of the continuing conspiracy by scientists in the ruling class. The left was just as extreme on paper. Co-signers of a statement in the New York Review of Books dismissed Wilson's book as an attempt to revive theories which had provided an important basis for the enactment of sterilization laws and eugenics policies which led to the establishment of gas chambers in Nazi Germany. By the time Wilson deplored this ugly, irresponsible, and totally false accusation, he had the vast majority of scientists on his side. Nowhere had he said that human behavior is determined by the genes. In rough terms, Wilson said, I see maybe 10% of human behavior as genetic and 90% as environmental. But such statements don't get us far if the effective cause, whether genetic or environmental, can only be established by observing the resulting behavior. If one thing happens, the genes dominate. If another, it's the environment. No outcome can falsify the theory. Meanwhile, the genes that are said to cause the behavior, or to cause it sometimes, have not been identified in a single instance. Lewontin and his allies did make such criticisms, but the science was often buried beneath comments so ill-advised that the New York Times, normally sympathetic to left-wing opinion, didn't hesitate to take Wilson's side. Hamilton's contribution. A key contribution to sociobiology was made by the evolutionary biologist William D. Hamilton. He would migrate from his chilly graduate student digs to the somewhat warmer waiting room at Waterloo Railway Station, where he was rewarded with a key insight. Darwin's theory had implied that natural selection would generate a selfish world. It was the fittest that survived, after all. Yet undeniably, there was a lot of altruism out there. Hamilton's explanation, published in 1964, took time to sink in. But once it did, the evolutionists sang their hosannas. Kin selection, of course. A particular gene exists.